Hello, listeners, and welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real-life courtroom drama. I want to first say thank you to everyone who has been listening and subscribing. Because of you, between the last episode and this one, the show hit a major milestone, so thank you very much for your continued support. I really appreciate it. I also really appreciate everyone who has called, texted, emailed, or sent me messages on social media about the show. I take all the feedback I get, and I try and use it to improve the show wherever I can, so keep them coming. With today's episode, we're going to move away a bit from the politically controversial topics that we've been covering recently and onto a culturally divisive topic. As always, we're going to limit any personal commentary onto the legal issues and arguments. Any opinion which listeners perceive I'm offering as to any moral or ethical behavior by any of the parties here is unintentional. It should not be taken as my personal opinion. And I apologize in advance that today's episode is going to run a bit long, but I think it's worth it to fully understand the issues that are going to be presented here. Over time, people have become less charged about the underlying accusations in today's show. But during the time period when they occurred, lines of belief were drawn, and families could be divided over which camp certain members put themselves. We're actually going to be discussing two cases today, one of which ended up not even resulting in an arrest, and the other one went to trial. But they're so intertwined that it would really be impossible to discuss one without giving listeners a basic understanding of the other. This will make a lot more sense as we get through the show, I promise. Throughout the 1980s and into the early 1990s, Michael Jackson was the undisputed king of pop. He was the most popular musician in the entire world. He could sing, he could dance, he released hit after hit dating back from his childhood singing with the Jackson 5. My generation can vividly remember watching the 1993 Super Bowl halftime show where Michael Jackson electrified the stage. We watched as the music videos for Bad, Thriller, Smooth Criminal, and Beat It were relatively modern and were visual entertainment masterpieces for the times. But in mid-1993, the world changed. Allegations surfaced that Michael Jackson had molested a boy by the name of Jordan Chandler. It was like a nuclear bomb had been dropped into the entertainment industry. The investigation was extensive. Hundreds of interviews were conducted. Jackson's life was publicly torn into and put under a microscope. The case ultimately settled, Jackson was never arrested or charged. But Jackson's reputation was destroyed, and he became a recluse for years. In the year 2000, Jackson was introduced to 10-year-old cancer patient Gavin Arvizo when his father was reaching out to celebrities to help finance his cancer treatments. Jackson and Arvizo became friends, and Arvizo visited Jackson's home, the Neverland Ranch, several times that year. Arvizo later became a part of a 2002 documentary on Jackson's life, which sparked another controversy about how Jackson acted with underage boys. Ultimately, Michael Jackson was arrested and prosecuted for child molestation and administering an intoxicating agent for the purpose of committing a felony. This is the state of California versus Michael Jackson. As I said before, there's a lot to cover in this episode, so I don't want to spend too much time on extraneous topics. But to really understand the case, there's a lot of important background information, which really impacts not only the story, but the legal arguments being made. Michael Jackson was born in Gary, Indiana, on August 29, 1958, as the eighth child of the Jackson family. His mother, Catherine, was a musician playing clarinet and piano, who also worked part-time at Sears. His father, Walter, was a former boxer and crane operator, who also played guitar for a local R&B band. At the age of eight, Michael and his brother Marlon were inserted into a band formed by his father, which ultimately became the Jackson 5. It included other Jacksons Tito, Jackie, and Jermaine. Despite the R&B group's significant success, Jackson claims that his father was abusive. He would physically beat him for making any mistakes at all in rehearsal. His father was emotionally distant his whole life and only ever seemed to care about commercial success, completely discounting the emotional health and well-being of any of the Jackson children. Michael Jackson's childhood was spent doing little other than rehearsing and performing, oftentimes at cocktail bars and lounges where strippers performed. As the group gained popularity, Jackson soon became the lead vocalist and frontman as the songs he was featured in became more and more popular. The complete consumption of Jackson's life by his participation in the Jackson 5 had a profound influence on him. Jackson never experienced childhood in a traditional sense. He did not really have friends after age 8. His school attendance was unorthodox at best, and there are obvious issues with socialization when a child interacts almost exclusively with adults and in a performance venue environment. Consequently, those close to Jackson later in life have frequently stated that he spent much of his adult years searching for a youthful innocence which he never really felt like he got to experience. Michael Jackson had continuous music hits from around 1968 until 1993. His name and musical reputation are so ubiquitous that we don't need to rehash his entire career, but I will say this. He is the most awarded artist in the history of popular music and is easily one of the best-selling artists of all time. He has sold roughly 350 million albums worldwide. His album Thriller is the best-selling album of all time. The first ever album to have five individual songs all chart as Billboard number one singles was Bad. Jackson has had a top 10 single in five different decades. He's won 15 Grammy Awards, a Golden Globe, and has 39 Guinness World Records. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame, the R&B Hall of Fame, and he is the only vocal recording artist to be inducted into the Dance Hall of Fame. Jackson was always a popular recording artist, but throughout the 1980s, he became an international superstar. He was everywhere. He had major endorsement deals with companies like Pepsi, and his tours were wildly successful. In February 1993, he performed the halftime show at Super Bowl XXVII in what is still widely considered one of the best, if not the best, Super Bowl halftime show of all time. Later on in February 1993, Jackson's car broke down. It was towed to a local garage called the Rent-A-Wreck. The owner of this facility was a man by the name of David Schwartz. When Jackson came in, he called his wife June to come down and bring her son, Jordan, to meet Michael Jackson. Jordan was born to June during a previous marriage to a man named Evan Chandler, a celebrity dentist who is also a co-writer of the 1993 comedy Robin Hood, Men in Tights. Jackson and Jordan Chandler hit it off and became friends. Jordan, along with his stepsister and mother, were invited to Jackson's estate, the Neverland Ranch, on weekends. This caused an issue because the visits would take place during the times where Jordan was supposed to be with his father, Evan. Jordan always preferred to go to the ranch, and when he did spend time with his father instead of with Jackson, Jordan made it clear that his preference would have been to be with Jackson instead. Evan wanted his son to be happy, and so initially Evan Chandler supported the friendship and encouraged Jordan to spend time with Jackson. Chandler even went so far as to suggest to Jackson that he should buy Chandler a home near to the Neverland Ranch so that he and Jordan could be closer. Ultimately, this didn't happen. But in May 1993, Jackson took Jordan and his mother June to Monaco for the World Music Awards as his guest. This created insane jealousy on the part of Evan Chandler, who was left behind. When they returned, Jackson stayed for nearly a week in June and David Schwartz's home, sleeping in Jordan's room. According to Evan Chandler, this is the point where he started to suspect that perhaps the relationship between Jackson and Jordan was more than simply friendship. In July of 1993, Evan Chandler was recorded in a telephone call with Jordan's stepfather, David Schwartz, where he threatened to expose Jackson as a pedophile and ruin Jackson's career. He also stated that he wanted to do this publicly and did not care how it would affect his son. Every time Chandler spoke to Jordan about Jackson, Jordan denied any inappropriate conduct and simply told his father that he and Jackson were best friends. Chandler refused to accept this, so in August of 1993, he came up with a plan. If you recall, Chandler was a celebrity dentist. Jordan needed a tooth extracted, so Chandler gave Jordan a heavy sedative, and while Jordan was under the effects of the sedative, Chandler asked Jordan extremely leading questions about whether Jackson had ever touched his private parts, and Jordan said yes. Armed with this, and only this, Chandler hired a lawyer and demanded $20 million from Jackson. Jackson scoffed at Chandler and countered him with $1 million just for Chandler to go away. When Chandler countered with $15 million, Jackson's lawyers lowered his offer to $350,000 just to show Chandler that they felt that he was nothing more than a nuisance with no case. It's important to keep in mind here that Chandler used a compound called sodium amytal on Jordan during the dental procedure. This puts people basically in a hypnotic state. Many studies have shown that people in that state are highly susceptible to suggestion and will parrot back answers to cues they receive from questions. Sodium amytal has also been linked to the creation of false memories. Now, a flurry of activity happens next in a relatively short period of time, so we'll try and keep the timeline straight. After Jackson effectively tells Chandler to buzz off, on August 17, 1993, Chandler has Jordan evaluated by a child psychiatrist named Dr. Mathis Abrams. Jordan tells Dr. Abrams that Jackson sexually abused him and that there was mutual masturbation and oral sex involved. The following day, August 18th, Chandler brought Jordan to the police. Jordan reiterated what he told Dr. Abrams, and a formal police investigation was commenced. On August 21st, a search warrant was executed at the Neverland Ranch. About 30 other children were questioned, all of whom were quote-unquote friends of Jackson. Each one of them told them that Jackson was not a child molester and that they just played together. On August 24th, the allegations were made public. Many people think that it was no coincidence that this was the same day that Jackson was set to begin the third leg of his extremely successful Dangerous World Tour, and that Chandler was trying to leverage Jackson's need to focus on the tour and the damage these allegations would cause to try and get him to settle quickly for a large number. In response to the public allegations, the Jackson team held a press conference later that same day and accused Chandler of attempting to extort $20 million from Michael Jackson. On August 31st, Chandler hired Gloria Allred, who made public statements claiming a civil lawsuit against Jackson was forthcoming. The following month, law enforcement ratcheted up their investigation, traveling to the Philippines to interview ex-employees. At the insistence of his father, Jordan Chandler had provided the police with a description of Jackson's penis. On December 20th, 1993, law enforcement obtained a warrant for a strip search of Michael Jackson. They brought him to the Santa Barbara County Sheriff's Department, and in a room with prosecutors, photographers, detectives, and bodyguards, forced Jackson to disrobe and photographed his naked body for 25 minutes. Jordan's description was determined not even to remotely resemble the reality captured by the photos. Without going into any gruesome detail, there was a conflict about circumcision, which is a mistake law enforcement did not expect someone with intimate knowledge to make. Meanwhile, on September 14, 1993, Chandler's lawyers filed their civil lawsuit against Jackson, claiming sexual battery, seduction, willful misconduct, intentional infliction of emotional distress, fraud, and negligence. Jackson's lawyers immediately filed for a stay in the civil case while the criminal investigation was ongoing. Let's take a brief moment here to discuss the relationship between civil and criminal cases which arise from the same or similar sets of facts because they can implicate each other. In almost every instance, the criminal case, if there is one, will go first, and the civil case will get what's called a stay, meaning it will just kind of sit in limbo until the criminal matter is resolved. There are good reasons for this. the most significant touches on a criminal defendant's Fifth Amendment right not to be forced to testify against him or herself in a criminal action. There is no correlating right not to testify in a civil trial, but testimony in civil trials and depositions is still testimony made under oath, and a civil plaintiff has the right to depose a defendant and ask them questions about the facts and circumstances which are the foundation of the lawsuit. If that were allowed to take place while a criminal investigation or formal prosecution is ongoing, it would put a criminal defendant in a position where either his Fifth Amendment right is violated or he is in civil contempt of court for refusing to take part in a deposition. There is no prohibition against law enforcement using sworn statements in a deposition as part of their investigation. In addition to the verbal statements, an issue could arise concerning discovery productions. That same Fifth Amendment protection, which shields a person from having to testify against him or herself, also shields that individual person from the production of evidence in discovery, which incriminates them in a criminal investigation. That particular protection, again, does not exist in the civil arena. So a civil defendant needs to be protected from a plaintiff issuing subpoenas for incriminating materials, which the plaintiff can then easily turn over to law enforcement. It should be noted that these criminal protections apply only to individuals, not corporations. So when law enforcement subpoenas business records or files, there is no ability to claim that the Fifth Amendment precludes production of such materials. Okay, back to Jackson, who had now canceled the rest of the Dangerous World Tour because of the allegations and was facing health concerns because of them. On January 25th, 1994, the civil lawsuit was settled for around $23 million. The settlement explicitly stated that Jackson was not admitting to any wrongdoing. The Los Angeles County District Attorney, Gil Garcetti, the father of current Mayor of Los Angeles Eric Garcetti, said the civil settlement had no effect on the criminal investigation and vowed to press on. There was a two-prong investigation going on at that time, one in Los Angeles County and one in Santa Barbara County, where the Neverland Ranch is. And grand juries in both Santa Barbara and Los Angeles failed to indict Jackson on any charges. With their money settlement, Chandler and Jordan stopped cooperating with law enforcement in July 1994, and eventually the case was closed and dropped by Santa Barbara District Attorney Thomas Snedden Jr., with no formal arrest. So that's the backdrop for the trial that we're going to discuss today. I know it was a lengthy background information, and it was a lot to take in, but I think having that understanding is going to be essential to evaluate what happens later. After the 1993 allegations, Jackson began to retreat from public life. He lost corporate endorsements like Pepsi. He did tour some, but mostly not in the United States. And he remained the constant topic of tabloid journalism stories promoting the idea that he was a pedophile. Fast forward now to the year 2000. The Chandler saga is finally behind him, and Jackson was focusing on music and moving on. Enter onto the scene David Arvizo. Arvizo had a 10-year-old son named Gavin, who was suffering from childhood cancer. David Arvizo often sought out celebrities to try and finesse some charitable donations to help pay for his son's chemotherapy and other cancer treatments. Arvizo was introduced to Jackson through a mutual friend. Similar to the situation we discussed before, Jackson and Gavin became friends. Gavin and his family were invited to Neverland Ranch, given gifts over the period of a few months. After a while, Jackson stopped calling and the relationship more or less ended. It wasn't public, there was no press or law enforcement involvement, just a few months of spending significant time with Michael Jackson, and then it was over. But 2 years later, in 2012, a filmmaker named Martin Bashir was filming a documentary called Living with Michael Jackson. Jackson invited Gavin, who is now 12, to come and be a part of the production. Jackson, who was then 44, was filmed on several occasions holding Gavin's hand, and vigorously defended on camera having sleepovers with young boys in the same bed. Bashir's initial intention in making the documentary was not to portray Jackson as a pedophile or sexual abuser, but that is how the film ultimately came across, and this prompted calls for yet another investigation by the local Santa Barbara District Attorney's Office and the Los Angeles Department of Child and Family Services. Once again, lines were immediately drawn. Several prominent child and former child actors defended Jackson, including McCauley and Kieran Culkin, who insisted that no abuse had ever taken place, despite them both having spent significant time with Jackson in sleepovers at the Neverland Ranch. Gavin Arvizo's mother, Janet, also criticized the documentary when it was first released, claimed it grossly distorted the truth. In June 2003, the district attorney for Santa Barbara, the county where, again, Neverland Ranch is situated, once again opened an investigation into Jackson's relationship with Gavin and other children. In November 2003, the Arvizo family abruptly changed their position on Jackson. Gavin told law enforcement interviewers that he had been molested in February and March while the documentary was being filmed. Janet Arvizo also claimed that they were essentially held prisoner at the Neverland Ranch during that time. They were not permitted to leave. On November 20, 2003, Michael Jackson was arrested and was then charged in a 10-count indictment with one count of conspiracy to commit child abduction, false imprisonment, and extortion, four counts of child molestation, one count of attempted child molestation, and four counts of administering an intoxicating agent for the purpose of committing a felony. Felony in this case being child molestation. In essence, the prosecution had represented to a grand jury that Jackson had given Gavin and his brother, Star, alcohol, and then molested them when they were in a compromised state. The case was assigned to the Honorable Rodney Melville. Judge Melville had no interest in turning the trial into a celebrity circus. He immediately issued a gag order on both parties and banned the media from the courtroom. He explicitly stated that there would be severe consequences for attempting to try the case in the media before the courtroom trial itself. Jackson went through several lawyers during his case. During the investigation, he had Ben Brofman from New York and Mark Garagos from Los Angeles. Brofman, if you listened to the show, also represented Martin Shkreli, covered in a previous episode. Both Ben Brofman and Mark Garagos were nationally known, high-profile, and very respected. They were also both fired the day before Jackson's arraignment. Jackson then rehired Thomas Messereau, who had represented him during the 1993 allegations, despite Jackson's public criticism of the settlement. With Messereau was Susan Yu. Jackson also retained Bob Sanger, as well as Brian Oxman, who was also eventually fired before the trial began. But there was no question that Thomas Messereau was the lead attorney. The prosecutor was Thomas Snedden Jr. Yes, the same Thomas Snedden Jr. who presided over the 1993 Santa Barbara investigation of Jackson. He was a career prosecutor who had obviously spent decades in the Santa Barbara DA's office. Snedden was always involved in issues involving children. He handled the bulk of the child molestation cases himself, also ardently supported stiff penalties for failure to pay child support. United States Attorney General Janet Reno pointed him to the Presidential Commission and Task Force to review prosecutions for failure to pay child support, a position which he was extremely proud of. The largest and most contentious issue pre-trial concerned the 1993 allegations and investigation. Snedden wanted to incorporate it into his case, and Messereau strenuously objected. For a more in-depth look at how a person's past conduct can be brought into a criminal trial, you should listen to the episode dealing with Phil Spector, which was also a California case. Here, Snedden argued that Jackson had exhibited a pattern of grooming, and that the 1993 allegations showed a particular modus operandi that would allow the jury to understand Jackson's particular pattern of behavior. Rather than propensity evidence, or evidence which simply shows that a defendant has criminal tendencies, and which is inadmissible at trial, Snedden claimed that this evidence rather went to the reliability of the testimony, because it would corroborate that Jackson's particular manner of grooming was consistent, and therefore that the testimony would be credible. Messereau, on the other hand, argued that this request was nothing more than an attempt to prejudice the jury by introducing prior acts which were never even determined by a grand jury to warrant prosecution, to tar Jackson's reputation, and to show the jury that Jackson is just a bad guy. Mesereau also claimed that the purported witnesses that Snedden wanted to introduce all had clear biases against Jackson. Judge Melville considered the arguments and ruled that the alleged victims and law enforcement could testify about the investigation, but that the out-of-court settlement was inadmissible. Judge Melville determined that the testimony would help the jury understand Jackson's purported modus operandi and was not being used as propensity evidence. Here is my personal take on this decision. It was dead wrong. Here's why. Snedden argued that Jackson's pattern of grooming and his particular modus operandi should be admissible. For actions to constitute a specific modus operandi, they have to be singular and unique enough that if two separate people accuse a defendant of doing it, it is unlikely that they could both have independently made it up, and thus, it is more likely that they are both telling the truth. Let me give you an example. Let's picture a bank robber. On Monday, he goes into Carl Rumpf's savings and loan, shows the teller a gun, empties the cash drawer, and runs away. Then on Friday, our bank robber goes into the Dave Kletzik Credit Union, shows the teller a gun, empties the cash drawer, and runs away. At his trial for the Kletzik Credit Union robbery, prosecutors cannot introduce evidence that he robbed Carl Rumpf's savings and loan because it's basic propensity evidence. The purpose of the evidence would be that he did it before, so he probably did it again. Now, let's picture our robber. But this time, when he goes into Rumpf's savings and loan, he's wearing a Donald Trump mask. He pulls out a hot pink pistol. He tells the bank teller his name is Inigo Montoya and that he only wants the $10 bills from the cash drawer. As he's walking out, he yells "Livin' la vida loca" at the door. Then he runs away. Now let's say that somebody strolls into the Kletzik Credit Union later that week. He's wearing a Donald Trump mask. He pulls out a hot pink pistol. He tells the teller his name is Inigo Montoya. He demands the $10 bills and only the $10 bills in the cash drawer. And as he's walking out the door, he turns back and yells "Livin' la vida loca" at the top of his lungs, and then runs away. This guy has a signature, a modus operandi. And obviously this is an extreme example to make a point. You can also consider the movie Home Alone. Marv, played perfectly by Daniel Stern, leaves the faucets on in every house he and Joe Pesci burglarize, calling the duo the Wet Bandits. Even that unique action could count as a modus operandi because it's out of the usual, and it's unlikely that two separate victims would independently make that up. The evidence then goes towards the credibility of the testimony, not towards a claim that a defendant did it before so that he did it again. Consequently, it is admissible evidence. Going back to the evidence against Jackson, here's my issue. Snedden's claim for the trial is that Jackson would give the boys alcohol, masked as juice or some other innocent drink, so that they would be compromised and Jackson could take advantage of them. In my research, I never came across any allegation by Jordan Chandler that Jackson provided him alcohol before molesting him. So when you get to the crux of Snedden's argument, what he is essentially saying is that the act of molestation itself is a modus operandi. And that's just simply too vague and general to be useful to the jury in determining if there's truth to the allegations. But Judge Melville saw it the other way and decided to allow it. The trial began on February 28, 2005, and lasted around 3 months. Despite cameras being banned from the courtroom, there was ample media coverage, and Jackson's erratic behavior fed into the frenzy. 2 weeks into the trial, when Gavin Arvizo was scheduled to take the stand, Jackson did not show up to court. Judge Melville threatened to revoke his bail if he didn't show within the hour. And right around an hour later, a seemingly confused Michael Jackson showed up to court in his pajamas and cried in front of the entire gallery. The trial was filled with other instances of Jackson behaving strangely or seeming incoherent. The trial consisted of two very simple storylines. prosecutors portrayed the King of Pop as an evil puppet master who orchestrated a complex conspiracy to groom Gavin and his younger brother, Star, and molested them twice each. Sten's team claimed that Jackson was a particular type of cruel, living out his obsession with young boys by keeping them captive on his estate and disarming them with gifts and alcohol. The defense, on the other hand, painted Jackson to be naive and childlike, a man who was frequently taken advantage of by the people he hired to help him and the people that he sought to help. In a bizarre turn of events, Jordan Chandler did not testify at Michael Jackson's trial. He left the country to avoid it. Jordan had emancipated himself, taking his $15 million from the Jackson settlement and basically left his parents long ago. His mother, June, did testify at Jackson's trial, claiming that Jordan had not spoken to her in roughly 11 years. She did not testify that Jackson had ever molested Jordan. Unfortunately, we don't have time to go through all the 140 total prosecution and defense witnesses and what they told the jury. What is interesting, however, is that it felt as though each time Sneddon produced a witness who testified either about Jackson's 1993 behavior or the 2002 timeframe, Messereau and his team were able to show that they were shopping the story around to tabloids, or were an employee fired for misconduct, or had some other legitimate bias. Now, these were big blows that Messereau was landing. One witness that we will discuss was Gavin's mother, Janet Arvizo. On direct, answering questions by the prosecutor, she testified that during the documentary filming, she and Gavin and Star were essentially imprisoned in Jackson's home. He wouldn't let them leave. She was necessary by the prosecution to make out the elements of the conspiracy to abduct charge, as she was the main and really the only witness who testified that her family was not allowed to leave the Neverland Ranch. But on cross-examination, she lost all of her credibility. Messereau brought up that she had committed perjury in the past, and that she had perpetrated a fraud against JCPenney in a lawsuit she had filed against them. At one point, she snapped her fingers at the jury and started to address them directly before being admonished by Judge Melville. Also, during the time period that she claimed she was being imprisoned, Messereau had receipts showing that she went on a $7,000 spending spree and was eating lavishly at fancy restaurants on Jackson's dime. And despite the parade of witnesses called in the case, the jury was faced with a fairly simple question. Did they believe Gavin and Star Arvizo that Jackson had plied them with alcohol and then molested them? And did they believe Janet Arvizo that the family was kept there against their will? Or did they believe that these were fabrications concocted for some other purpose? Cases like this tend to balloon outwards, with extraneous issues being raised, like Jackson's 1993 behavior, which ends up requiring more witnesses to counter it, and then more witnesses are then called to corroborate and then counter the corroboration. But at the end of the day, the question boiled down to the elements of the 10 crimes. 2 counts of giving alcohol to Gavin, 2 counts of molesting him. 2 counts of giving alcohol to Star, and 2 counts of molesting him. 1 attempt to molest Gavin, and 1 count of conspiracy to imprison the Arvizos in Jackson's home. This could have been done with far fewer than 140 witnesses. At the conclusion of the 3-month trial, after supporting testimony from Macaulay Culkin, Wade Robeson, George Lopez, Jay Leno, and Chris Tucker, a jury found Jackson not guilty of all 10 charges. In summation, and just my personal opinion here, but I believe that it never sat right with Sneddon that the 1993 grand jury refused to indict based on Jordan Chandler's testimony. And I think that caused some overzealous pushing for the 2003 case. I think Sneddon felt as though Jackson had gotten away with it in 1993, and because of that, he was not as discerning as he probably should have been about the 2002 allegations, and had a preconceived idea about Jackson as a dark and evil figure, and discarded red flags. The jurors, after the trial, were very willing to express how they came to acquit. Essentially, they came to the conclusion that Janet Arvizo had coached her children into making these claims in a money grab. They felt she simply wasn't credible. They felt that the children's stories weren't credible and that there was no evidence to support that anything had ever happened. They adamantly denied that Jackson's fame had anything to do with it and would only say that their observations of him during the trial did not appear to sync with the way the prosecution was claiming that he was. The jury also said that they found the testimony of other celebrities who claimed that the Arvizos had tried to bilk them for as much money as they could get very compelling. The testimony of June Chandler, they said, was not a factor to them. Some final thoughts on this case, and again, apologies for going a bit long in this episode. Juries will often catch a lot of flack for their decisions to acquit in cases which attract national media attention. Think of the O.J. Simpson case, George Zimmerman case, Casey Anthony. These are all examples of media pundits immediately rushing to condemn the jury and asserting that they were simply wrong and made a mistake or bought off, whatever. As laypeople, I think we have a tendency to feel the same way, but I want to caution you against that. Because unless you're a juror in the case, you cannot possibly know what the evidence presented to them actually was, how it was presented, and whether it came off as believable. For the most part, we, as the general public, get our information about trial proceedings from how news stories cover them. As I said in the show's first few episodes, in my own personal experience, reading news stories of trials I've been involved in, journalists tend to be more interested in getting readers and clicks than accurately portraying what happened. So what a jury actually saw and heard is likely way different than what you and I are being told they experienced. And that brings me back to another point I've made before. Your choice of attorney matters. The best trial lawyers understand the composition of their jury and how to craft a narrative that the jury will accept. They know which arguments to make and which jurors will see as a waste of time or an attempt to hide something or shift focus. News accounts rarely pick up on that. In my opinion, that's how Thomas Mesereau was able to convince a jury that Jackson was innocent, despite the introduction of the 1993 allegations. Mesereau knew that the key to the case was making this about Jackson being routinely taken advantage of by people who viewed him as a potential payday. I don't know whether Jackson molested any children or not, but I do know that based on the quality of his representation, it is now clear that every single person who has ever accused Michael Jackson has attempted to turn those accusations into monetary gains. And I, for one, remain suspicious of that. I hope you enjoyed this unintentionally extended episode of In Summation, The Final Word, and found the peculiar case of Michael Jackson's trial as interesting as I do. I also want to send a belated happy birthday to my wife, Serena. Without her encouragement, I never would have actually put this show together. Thank you, as always, to Dan Townsend, whose guidance and skill is continually improving the audio quality of the show, despite my persistent ignorance. And I want to say also a very special thank you to my law school listeners, who apparently I have, some of whom have reached out not only about the show, but also about legal practice. I am always happy to speak to listeners of the show about legal issues, the show itself, or any aspects of being a lawyer which law students may have questions about, so please keep them coming. If you're interested about practical aspects of law practice, fire away. On that note, you can reach me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com, can tweet me at insummationpod, or find me on my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Ask me a question, send me a recommendation, highlight a legal issue you want to know more about, or just compliment my voice. I'm open to all of it. Thank you all again so much for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more. Thank you.